Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. Now that we are told the Republican frontrunner has a solid, if not insurmountable, lead, we'll begin with a look into who Mitt Romney is. Scott Hellman, a staff writer at the Boston Globe and co-author of a new book, The Real Romney, joins us. We'll explore the candidate's formative years and learn what makes the man, not the robot, tick. Then we'll get an insightful briefing on what's holding Syria together and what's tearing it apart, as well as examining the role of the outside powers and the regional players now embroiled in a proxy war that could go on for a considerable time. Aram Nagesian, a visiting fellow and the Ali Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, joins us. We'll discuss the Assad family clan and its mafia-like domination of both Syria's politics and its economy as the civil war intensifies to the point Syria could become the Somalia of the Mediterranean, with arsenals of chemical and biological weapons proliferating. Then finally, we will assess how the West might deal with another presidency of Vladimir Putin, who just won the Russian election amid charges of fraud and growing protests at home. Daniel Treisman, a professor of political science at UCLA and author of The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev, joins us. We will discuss why President Obama has yet to congratulate Putin on his victory while mentioning at yesterday's White House press conference that he looked forward to meeting Putin at Camp David during the G8 summit. And joining us now is Scott Hellman, a staff writer at the Boston Globe, where he has worked as a reporter and an editor for more than a decade. He was previously the paper's political editor and a national political reporter, serving as a lead writer on the 2008 presidential campaign. His new book, co-authored with Michael Kranich, is The Real Romney. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Hellman.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, the title of your new book, The Real Romney, is that to suggest that the one that we're seeing out on the campaign trail is the unreal Romney?
No, it really was to suggest that there was somebody who was at once a household name and yet completely unknown. I mean, we thought that Mitt Romney remained something of an enigmatic presence to most Americans, even though they know his name. There's not much more that they know. So we set out to draw on our 20-some years of reporting on him as a newspaper to write the only really full biography of him that exists.
And now he's back in your town, Boston, apparently having said that he was looking forward to being home and sleeping in his own bed. What do you think he's thinking of this morning?
I think this is going better than it looks for him. Look, it's not been a great primary campaign in the sense that he's clearly had trouble connecting with conservative voters. We saw that again yesterday, despite his big delegate win at Super Tuesday. So, at the same time, I think, as his campaign said today, that it might even be mathematically impossible for his rivals to actually get the number of delegates needed. So this is very much where Mitt Romney's comfortable, in a long slog for delegates.
Right, but he's only a third of the way there in terms of the delegates, and coming up is Kansas, Alabama, Mississippi, and Missouri, all fairly conservative states. And if Santorum is able to get Gingrich out of the way, not that that's likely, but at least he's going to try. I mean, frankly, it would be a different race had it not been, don't you think, Scott Hellman, for the fact that so much of the anti-Romney vote is being split between Santorum and Gingrich?
Sure. I mean, Mitt Romney's been very lucky that Newt Gingrich is so stubborn. It's clearly helped him to split the anti-Romney vote. And yes, there are upcoming contests that I think he will probably lose. But again, because of the way that the delegates are apportioned this year, which is proportional in many places, Mitt Romney doesn't have to win every state. He can win congressional districts here and there, and he can pick up delegates here and there, even in unfriendly places. So I think at the end of the day, I would be very surprised if anyone else but Romney makes it to that delegate threshold.
So Scott Hellman, again, staff writer at the Boston Globe, co-authored with Michael Kranich the new book, The Real Romney. Give us a sense then of, I've heard that one of the reasons, and you can certainly set us straight on this, that one of the reasons that Romney comes across as being kind of stiff and robotic, as many have said, is that the real Romney is only on display amongst his friends and a close circle of friends, and particularly within the kind of world of the Mormon Church that he's been obviously deeply involved in, there being a bishop. It's not the same as a Catholic bishop, obviously, but he's been prominent in the church. Is there anything to that?
Oh, very much so. I mean, there are very different portraits of Mitt Romney that you get depending on who you ask. I mean, he keeps a very tight circle of friends and family. You're right that many of those friends and certainly his family are in the Mormon Church. And those are the people who see somebody they describe as warm and funny and human and not robotic and not stiff and not wood and all the things that we see him described as. And yet, even if you get a little bit outside of that circle, even if you're somebody who worked for him or worked with him, you don't see that side of him. He is all business. He's you know, if you're a staff member for him, he, many people told me, he's not terribly interested in, you know, how your kid's doing at college or what your dog's name is or how your kids are, what your wife is up to. It can be very shallow interactions with him. And these aren't people who just run into him. I mean, these are some people who worked for him for years. And so I think if you're not in that inner circle, you have a very different picture of him. And that's, I think, you know, of course, part of what we see on the campaign trail. Most people, are, of course, are not in his inner circle. And they're seeing the controlled, robotic, difficult to connect with man up there. And I think that's going to be certainly a challenge for him. It already has been a challenge for him, but it certainly will be amplified in a general election campaign.
Well, it's odd in a way, Scott Hellman. It very much sounds like Al Gore. He's got an Al Gore problem, because Al Gore, from all the people who I've talked to who have met him and know him socially, says he's just a funny, self-deprecating guy. But as a candidate, he was so wooden and robotic that, you know, he's almost Romney's twin.
I think there's probably some truth to that. I never covered Al Gore closely, but I've certainly heard that as well. And look, I mean, you can say some similar things about President Obama. I mean, they're much different people, and they come from very different backgrounds, and I think they're much different thinkers. But there is a detachment that they both share, and you know, it's. I mean, we describe in the book that, I mean, Mitt Romney is absolutely the antithesis of that gregarious politician who you might see in a bar after a big, you know, political convention, or you see him getting a sandwich and he'll chat with you, and he'll trade gossip, and he'll want to know how you're doing, and he'll try to, you know, ingratiate himself into you and your circle of friends, your conversation. I mean, he is not like that. He goes the other way. He does not want small talk. He doesn't need it. He doesn't crave it. And he's, you know, when it comes down to it, he's introverted.
So he's no Bill Clinton, because Bill Clinton, apparently, everybody that's interacted with him is that, you know, he makes you feel like you're the most important person in the world and knows the name of your dog and your ex-wife, you know.
Right. I think Bill Clinton would be a good foil for Mitt Romney in many ways. Yeah.
Right. So tell me about then in your book, again, Scott Hellman, staff writer at the Boston Globe, he co-authored along with Michael Krenish the new book, The Real Romney. Let's begin with his father, with whom Mitt had a close but complicated relationship. And now there again, talk about analogies. That sounds a little bit like George W. Bush and G.H.W. Bush, right?
That's right. I mean, Mitt Romney grew up in a political household. His father, George, was a successful auto executive and three-term governor of Michigan, and a popular one at that. And Mitt has been very open about this. I mean, he has said that he worshipped his father, and he idolized him, and he hung on every word and just was endlessly fascinated by him. And friends will tell you that Mitt Romney has patterned his own life after his father's in many ways. They were both successful in business, went into politics at about the same time. Of course, George Romney ran for president in 1968. A lot of people feel like Mitt is trying to avenge that loss in some way by running himself. But the reality is it is a lot more complicated than that, and they're very different people. And they had very different political profiles. George Romney was a very outspoken moderate. He was brash and he was blunt-spoken. He stormed out of the 64 convention because of the way the Republicans weren't dealing with civil rights. I mean, very, very different stylistically and politically than Mitt Romney, who, of course, is now trying to court the conservative vote. He's much more disciplined, much more careful, much more scripted. So, you know, on one hand, yes, he's very much following in his father's footsteps. On the other, they're very different people, and Mitt is cutting his own path.
So I'm just trying to get a sense then of whether, because Romney, as you mentioned, the father stormed out of the convention because the Republicans weren't dealing with civil rights. He ran to the left of of Nixon. And Mitt Romney has mentioned on a number of occasions his father marching with Martin Luther King. So what's the story here? Does, when you say the son admires the father, does he admire the father's more, you know, liberal or diverse political outlook? Or is it just that the Republican Party back in the days of Richard Nixon, I mean, in many ways, Richard Nixon probably wouldn't find a home in today's Republican Party, right?
Sure. I mean, certainly it is tricky to draw comparisons because the eras are different and the politics are different. And who knows how George Romney would have fared in the era of the Tea Party. So by all means, yes, it's not a perfect comparison. But I think at the same time, they are very different people. And I think certainly Mitt Romney looked up to his father and talks about him occasionally on the campaign trail. And I think, again, endeavored to be him in many ways. And frankly, early on in his political career, he was much more like George Romney, at least ideologically. I mean, Mitt Romney's first campaign for office was in 1994 against Ted Kennedy for the U.S. Senate. And I mean, that Mitt Romney who ran that campaign is virtually unrecognizable today when we watch him run for president. So, you know, clearly Mitt Romney has grown more conservative over his career. It's hard to know what his own father would have made of that.
Well, Scott Hellman, again, co-author with Michael Krenishov, the new book, The Real Romney. What do you make of it? I mean, are his opponents, particularly Santorum and Gingrich, who don't miss an opportunity to refer to him as a Massachusetts moderate, do you think that's who he really is? Or has he evolved and moved to the right? Or is he just accommodating the fact that the Republican Party has moved to the right?
I think he's at heart a pragmatist. I mean, he has always looked at the situation in front of him, gathered as much information as he could, and gathered smart people around him, and then tried to make a decision to suit the moment. And that has served him very well in his life. Of course, it served him tremendously well in business, where he made piles and piles of money for him and his partners. And I think he's applied that to politics in a lot of ways. I mean, he ran again in 94 as somebody very different than he is today. Even in 2002, when he ran for governor of Massachusetts, he was that Massachusetts moderate. He was an appealing Republican brand in many ways. He was exactly the kind of Republican Massachusetts voters like to elect as governor. And then over the course of that term, he shifted fairly significantly to the right and on a number of issues. And look, I think his campaign team saw the opening on the right, and they set out to fill it. And it was clearly not successful, or, you know, he would have been the nominee 4 years ago. And I think he's still running as that person, I think, but they made a calculation this campaign to really run on the economy, because that's the one thing that, you know, really is in Mitt Romney's wheelhouse. So, you know, people still debate, well, you know, which one was it? Was he faking it then, or was he faking it now, or sort of what his principles are? I mean, certainly he has changed on a number of things, and the fact that people don't, you know, that conservatives don't fully trust him and don't fully believe he's one of their own is why we're still talking about a race, you know, here in mid-March.
Well, but it's pretty obvious, isn't it, that and having written this biography about him, the real Romney, isn't it clear that he's been running for president for at least this has been in his mind? I mean, he sort of built the perfect resume in a way, the way that George Bush's father had the perfect resume. And you can't help feeling that he took on the job for the Olympics as a way to get a national profile. And he's been running, obviously, and it seems in many ways in the Republican Party, you get your turn. You know, Reagan had to run twice before he got it, and Bush had to run, Senior had to run twice before you got it. It seems like he's had a fairly calculated long career. And if that is true, why do you think he wants to be president?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, this is something he's, I think, thought about doing for many, many years. And you will hear, if you talk to friends, you'll hear stories about how he was careful very, very early on in his business dealings because he knew he would be running for public office. And he told a friend once when he was really barely 30 years old that he didn't want to enter into some shady real estate deal because if I ever run for office, he said, this is not something I'd want people to know about. So you're absolutely right. Look, I think he's somebody, in his wife's words, he loves a catastrophe. He likes a crisis. He thinks that he is the one best suited to come in and fix things. That was true at the Olympics, certainly. It was true at various times in his career at Bain. And it was true to some extent when he took over as governor of Massachusetts when we were facing a big budget problem. And in his mind, the country is a mess. And he is Mr. Fix-It, and he's the only one with the goods to turn it around. Now, I think his central challenge this fall, assuming he is the nominee, is if the economic numbers continue to get a little bit better and people have a little bit of hope that things are okay or getting better or that finally the economy is on the march a little bit, I think Mitt Romney is going to have a real problem because the rationale for his candidacy is that this country is going in the wrong direction and only he can turn it around.
But Scott Hellman, you say that he really believes that the things are in dire shape because on the campaign trail, when he incessantly talks about Barack Obama all the time, it sort of reaches a point of almost kind of ridiculousness. It's like, you know, I like apple pie and ice cream, but Barack Obama, not only does he not like apple pie, he doesn't like ice cream, you know?
Right. Just, or he's made everyone's apple pie and ice cream taste worse.
Yes. it's almost juvenile at times listening to it, you know?
Certainly, though. I mean, in fairness, you hear a lot on both sides of that. I mean, I can remember, perhaps not exactly the same thing, but I can remember some comments that were made your eyes roll during the 2008 Democratic primary about George W. Bush. So, you know, in some ways, that goes hand in hand with a party primary driven by the ideologically pure in many ways. But you're right. I think that language is increasingly out of step, and he's going to have to find a way to calibrate it if the country does manage to march back a little bit, as it seems to be doing here in these last few months.
So tell us about some of the stuff in the book that gives you insight into his formative years. What was it that happened when he was a Mormon missionary in France, this fatal car crash, and it apparently had a profound effect on him throughout his life?
Yeah, I think that's really his 2.5 years as a Mormon missionary, I think, are really critical in terms of his formative years. I mean, he had grown up in a comfortable family in suburban Detroit. He'd gone off to Stanford University for a year and started to get a little bit of a taste of the outside world there at Stanford. But and remember, this was the mid to late 60s, so the anti-war movement was just gaining steam. Counterculture was coming into favor. Mitt Romney was getting a taste of that. And right at the moment, though, that he started to really be interested in and explore it and try to find his place in the world, he gets sent off to France for 2.5 years as a Mormon missionary. And he emerges after those 2.5 years much closer to his faith, in his words, much much more determined to live a life of purpose. And I think it was a hard 2.5 years for him in many ways. You mentioned the car crash. He was driving the car one day full of Mormons, and a Catholic priest in a Mercedes came swinging around a bend, smashed into their car, more or less head-on. The wife of the French mission president was killed. It was a very traumatic event, and young Mitt Romney and a colleague really helped run the French mission for a few months while the woman's husband was away. This was a big test of his leadership. And again, it only sort of cemented this idea of in his mind that he wanted to live a life of purpose and do something serious. And so from that time on, you see him, he returns to the States, he marries Anne, his wife, he transfers to Brigham Young University, a very conservative, largely Mormon campus, and then from there he's off and running to Harvard Business School, law school. You know, he basically becomes the Mitt Romney we see today in many ways. So I really see those years in France as the sort of the fulcrum on which his life really, really turns.
So just in closing, though, did he have a dalliance with the counterculture before? Because he seems like a guy that escaped the 60s, you know?
It's true. And no, what I mean to say is that he was not, I mean, he certainly did not have a dalliance with it. I think, in fact, there are pictures of him at Stanford actually protesting the protesters. So he was appalled by a lot of that and was not moved to join them. But by his own description, his connection to his faith before he went was quote, pretty thin tissue, even though he'd grown up in this Mormon household. So I think he'd begun to explore and get a little taste of the outside world, even if he didn't. Certainly he was not growing his hair long and, listening to Janis Joplin. I mean, this is not, no, this, that has never been Mitt Romney. Certainly is not Mitt Romney today. But he was, right as all of that was kind of gaining steam and really getting a lot of attention, and the foment really started, Mitt is pulled out in this remote French town trying to convince a Catholic country to join the Mormon Church. So it's true that he missed the 60s in a lot of ways, even though he did have some interaction with it before he left, and then also certainly while he was in France, because France had its own social unrest at the time.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Scott Hellman.
My pleasure. It's great to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Hellman, who's a staff writer at the Boston Globe, where he has worked as a reporter and an editor for more than a decade. He was previously the paper's political editor and a national political reporter, serving as the lead writer on the 2008 presidential campaign. His new book, co-authored with Michael Cranish, is The Real Mitt Romney. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a specialist on Syria.
That's worked out pretty well so far. But when they see the kind of person that you really are, then you won't be laughing so hard. No, you won't be laughing so hard. طلعوا يهتفوا له شافوا البواريد يمه قالوا اخوتنا هن ومش رح يضربونا سمعت هالشباب يمه الحرية.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Aram Nagizian, who is a visiting fellow with the Ali Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he specializes in security, politics, and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. Aram Nagizian has authored or co-authored a number of reports at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risk of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, The Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and his books include Israel and Syria, The Military Balance, and The Prospects of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aram Nagizian.
Happy to be here.
And the Assad regime in Syria not only have total political power, it seems that they have also completely cornered the market on economic opportunity. Is that the case?
Well, this is a paradigm you have under Bashar. It was very different under Hafez. His father was much more keen on redistribution of capital, was much more keen on sustaining links with the rural periphery and the urban poor, which were the traditional base of the Ba'ath Party. Bashar has been far less successful and far less capable in terms of his leadership in managing those types of dynamics.
So is that to say that he's a beneficiary of the family kleptocracy, or is he just turning a blind eye?
It's a bit of both. This is not the kind of Assad structure that Hafez would have wanted. There was much more emphasis on centralized Ba'athi politics, much more emphasis on trying to shore up popular support. What Bashar has done is allow the emergence, and rather the flourishing of, a business community that isn't productive, that doesn't have any real positive effects on the broader macroeconomics of the country, with limited trickle-downs microeconomically. You have families and communities like the Makhloufs, for example, that essentially run key elements of the Syrian economy as gatekeepers. Because of that, you have a Assad structure that is deeply dependent on this symbiosis with these crony capitalists, and they're an integral part of the regime's survival strategy from a financial standpoint.
And, of course, the Makhloufs, prominent amongst them, is Rami, Bashar al-Assad's cousin, who's supposedly worth about $5 billion, at least up until recently when the Syrian economy tanked.
That's correct. I mean, one of the core things we forget after a year of unrest is that the initial drivers in Syria were not that different from the drivers of unrest in other countries like Egypt and Libya and otherwise. namely that you have fundamental socioeconomic grievances, perceptions of corruption, perceptions of inequality, and poor governance. And that really hasn't changed a year later. It's just that we have forgotten that these are the core issues. And a lot of the initial anger at the popular level, before being leveled at Assad himself, were leveled at those who were synonymous with the crony capitalist system, like Rami Makhlouf.
And of course, another member of the family, the Makhloufs, is Hafez. Hafez is a prominent in the state security service. I must say, listening to what you're telling us here, Aram Nagizian, is you can't help feeling that's also analogies with Putin's Russia or KGB Incorporated. And there's no question that he's created a kind of form of crony capitalism regulating the oligarchs. In this case, there are obviously far fewer in Syria. I just did an interview yesterday with a veteran war correspondent who covered the Chechen wars, particularly the Second Chechen War, prosecuted by Putin. And he had developed survival skills there because every time he used a satellite phone, the Grad rockets would come in right on cue. And he actually briefed Mary Colvin, the woman who was just recently killed in Homs. As he was leaving, she was coming in, and he told her about how the Russians are tracking satellite phones and how to use them sparingly and take the batteries out. And when you use them, get the hell out of where you just were. Ironically, it doesn't seem like somehow she forgot that message. But the point of the interview was, and this fellow has an article currently at Foreign Policy, making the analogies between, or connections between, Russian strategies in Chechnya, particularly killing the messengers in terms of reporters, and Syrian strategies now being employed in Homs and other areas. So give us a sense of how deep this relationship is, aside from the kind of analogies that I'm drawing.
Well, and I can understand why an analogy with Russia is tempting. But one has to also bear in mind that you have similar parallels in terms of the militarization of social welfare or the rising up of basically non-productive sectors of the business elite to be part of the regime in places like Egypt. A lot of the grievances there were also driven by similar socioeconomic grievances against higher-ranking NDP members who also had significant financial investments. That also applies to the military, which has a lot riding on its prospects for managing a post-Mubarak Egypt. But in terms of the dynamic with the press, I mean, one of the challenges you have in a parallel with Russia is that the Russians are notorious for mismanaging freedom of expression and the press in terms of their own internal press structures with journalists. The problem you have in Syria is that you have a war zone where the reality of war reporting has come, you know, essentially full circle. People have to come to terms with that. When people go out to places like Syria, where you have no real government authority in places like Homs at the time, and certainly no sanction by the central government, these kinds of things will happen. This is a regime that is trying to control an already broken message about its authority, its authenticity. You have underlying social pressures from communities that still rely on Assad maintaining power that go well beyond the business crony elites like the Makhloufs. So you have a lot of elements that tie into this, some that don't really see eye to eye. Arguably, minorities like the Turkmens, the Christians of the country, don't necessarily like any of what's happening in the country and think that Assad and his cronies have mismanaged everything. That doesn't mean they can break rank. It goes well beyond this. There is a reality that there is crony capitalism taking place in places like Syria. There is a reality of mismanaging perception through the media, and there has been a targeting of the press. The bigger issues are, in the long term, tied into how the balance of power in the country will shape out. And things like freedom of expression and the press are relegated to second tier.
Again, I'm speaking with Aram Nagizian, who's a visiting fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's also the author of Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects of War. But not to belabor the Russian analogy, don't you think, though, Aram Nagizian, that there are some sort of almost atavistic Cold War reminiscences here, if you will? How much is this shaping up as a proxy war with the Russians making such a stand, along with the Chinese, for the Syrian regime in the United Nations, supplying them, and they have a major naval base there as well. And apparently the equipment that they're supplying is being used against the Syrian people.
Well, there certainly is a proxy battle taking place in Syria, but it's a bit more nuanced than the one you painted. In terms of the Russians and the Chinese, the problem we have now is that you have a much stronger rhetoric at the level of the international community in the West about the right to protect and humanitarian intervention writ large. The problem is that it's far more nuanced. You have players like the Russians and the Chinese who are thinking of things in much more classic balance of power terms, not really paying attention to things like humanitarian politics. The real proxy battle that's taking shape is a regional one. In the last 10 years or so, three key pillars of the inter-Arab order, namely Iraq, Egypt, and Syria, are either no longer relevant or no longer able to sustain their roles in shaping inter-Arab politics. So the Arab League has essentially become the Gulf Cooperation Council and everyone else. And the GCC states have found a unique opportunity not only to further their ambitions of consolidating the inter-Arab structure around them in ways that are conducive to trade, conducive to business ties, conducive to stability, but that also allow the Gulf states to confront Iranian influence indirectly without having to contend with a potential hot war in the Gulf, competition at Hormuz, and of course a military option against nuclear program in Iran, which no one can assume is going to lead to stability in the Gulf. So what you have now is Syria as an arena where opposition forces can increasingly count on at least the rhetorical support of southern Gulf states. The Assad regime can count on Iran. And at the international level, you have the Chinese, the Russians, the United States. But arguably, the larger players are far more difficult in terms of how they maneuver, far slower in reacting to the shifts on the ground. Regional players are much more entangled in the fate of the region, much more entangled in how Syria plays out. So you have not only a two-level contest pitting local actors against regional players like Iran and Gulf states led by Saudi Arabia, you also have a third level with the international community pitting the West against Russia and China.
So in other words, you're saying that the analogy that I made of a kind of revival of the Cold War, a proxy war between Russia and the West, is not the real arena in this case. It is a proxy war, if you will, between Iran and the Saudis and the Gulf. And my understanding is that the Saudis, and particularly the Qataris, have already been supplying arms. The Qataris, I believe, have supplied a brigade that was trained in Libya. How much is the Free Syrian Army being aided, abetted, armed, funded, etc., by the Saudis and the Qataris?
Well, on the issue of the proxy war, you know, the idea that this could be a broader international one, that's still playing out. There's a very real risk that this could be a proper international proxy contest. The Russians, the Chinese, and the U.S. might look at this very differently a few months down the road. There are areas of commonality of interest. There's a common interest in minimizing Syrian spillover effects. So for now, we are focusing core on the regional cycle of unrest and how these players tie into that. The Gulf states have done more than just rhetoric. Whether or not they provided the kinds of support that we can expect if this becomes much hotter, that still remains to be seen. Certainly there are flows of weapons from any number of countries around Syria, critically among them from Iraq, Lebanon. Certainly Turkey, with its 900-kilometer border, has also been very, very cautious about how smuggling can affect instability along its frontier with Syria. So this is looking a lot like a protracted crisis. You have the Iranians who are funneling support for the Assad regime, and you have the southern Gulf states, which have been led initially by the Qataris at a rhetorical level, but we really also have seen the coming out of the Saudis in terms of coming to the front of this. The Saudis traditionally have been far more reluctant to lead from the front on issues like this. They've always preferred to either put on an international face or regional face or have other actors play the leading role while they provide support from the rear. We saw after the collapse of the Arab League effort through the mission structure that the Saudis essentially decided to come out and say, we are the lead player in the Gulf on this. It doesn't mean that Qataris are out of the equation. It just means that a lot of this is now being driven by Saudi. So we are looking at a protracted regional crisis. I wouldn't be surprised if months from now you still have this playing out. In many ways, it isn't that different from Lebanon or Iraq. These are arenas for competition. The core problem with Syria is that it's the regional nexus for all things linked to instability along sectarian lines, proximity to Israel, proximity to other states that have their own internal divisions, like Lebanon and Iraq. And of course, the fact that the Turks are so concerned is always tied to the Kurdish question and the potential of instability of a rather large minority at home.
So, Aram Nagizian, how can we distinguish then between official support at the state level and that's coordinated? For example, the Saudis, Qataris, are they coordinating with the Turks? If the Turks are worried about informal smuggling going on, which you've alluded to, I would have thought that there is some kind of coordination. There's also a border with Jordan, and obviously, Iraq is run by the Shia, but in the area bordering on Syria is the Anbar Sunni area. That creates probably internal problems for that rather unstable government. I'm just trying to get a sense of, because it seems to me, in the case of the United States, and Hillary Clinton's alluded to this, that the U.S. is not directly involved, but to some extent maybe is turning a blind eye to those who are.
Well, one has to look at the ring states around Syria and then factor in what the Free Syrian Army is and how that plays into their calculus about coordinating assistance. Jordan is under increasing pressure from within, from Islamist politicians and parties that have been asking the monarchy to play a more positive role and a more aggressive role in terms of getting involved in Syria. And this has very much less to do with Syria and much more to do with mobilizing any kind of opportunity to contest the monarchy. So you have these internal pressures. In the case of Iraq, yes, Sunnis and Shiites are essentially divided against each other. You have a Sunni community that feels that they need to play their part in supporting the majority Sunni opposition forces in the country. You certainly have Islamists in Iraq who are keen to support their brethren in Syria as well. And of course, while the Shiites of Iraq have always had this rocky relationship with the Assad family, it's still a case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The dynamics here are such that the Shiites of Iraq will largely bandwagon with Iran. They face a much more critical threat from having another Sunni power on their border than having to manage a problematic but relatively predictable from a regional standpoint, Alawite leadership. And we saw with Lebanon that there's always a risk of instability. You have Sunni-Shiite tension, and that's something that we've seen rise over the last 5 years. But more recently, you've seen an upturn and spike in Alawite-Sunni tension in the north of the country. And this is before you have any real spillover effects. If things were to truly get out of hand, peripheral states like these are likely to become far less stable, far less predictable. And the Turks have also been very reticent about what to do about Syria for the next reason, which is that they look at the opposition structure, they look at the regime, and a lot of the assumptions that the international community and regional actors made a few months ago, two among them critically, that first of all, the Assads would be embattled and would be in a much weaker position than they are now, and second, that the opposition would be able to get its act together and be far more cohesive and have some kind of a structure or a mailing address for assistance. Neither of those two has really played out. The Assad regime, with its security apparatus, has proven far more resilient than anyone expected. And the opposition forces continue to remain divided against each other, cellular in their structure, and with very little cohesion in terms of the armed effort against the Assad regime. And there is no unity about whether this is supposed to be a defensive or an offensive structure. So this is becoming far more complicated than anyone expected. There are real risks of radicalization. And as the conflict metastasizes, it's not clear to me exactly how regional states can effectively support opposition forces in a cohesive fashion. It's far more likely that, like in Lebanon, and in many ways like in Libya now, you'll have militias that can be co-opted, that can be espoused for particular types of support by regional states. And if this cycle continues, and if you still have an environment where the Assad regime cannot exert sufficient control, there is no reason to expect regional states will not play this proxy game for the long term.
So just in closing then, Aram Nagizian, given the way that the Syrian regime now has taken Homs, and apparently it's taking on the Free Syrian Army piecemeal, not all at once, but it seems to be effectively rolling them up. And you're saying they're already divided and cellular to begin with. It's not unreasonable then to assume that the Assads are going to deal a fairly strong blow to this nascent Free Syrian army. So are you suggesting then that we'll just have a prolonged guerrilla war after this? There won't be a decisive military victory, or one way or the other?
Well, it's very easy to look at 1 year of unrest and say that things are going to wrap up in a way that it'll be decisive. The problem is that we saw in the last cycle of unrest in Syria, in the late 70s through the 82, we're talking about a six-year period. Now, mind you, that 6 years without mass media, without the internet, and without satellite television, things have moved much quicker, much faster, and attention has come on Syria in ways that it couldn't have in the context of the Cold War. What we're looking at now is a protracted crisis where you have attrition on both sides. You're going to see a regime that's going to do everything it can to roll up as much of the opposition as it possibly can, and will take advantage of the fact that they are so divided. Does this mean that Assad's survival is guaranteed? By no measure. There's every reason to expect that economic and social pressures can take their toll on their own. The reality, though, is that because this is a proxy battle, any settlement of what happens in Syria in the long term will have much more to do with the balance of power in the country and much less to do with whether or not Assad himself actually survives in power. You're looking at a Syria that, if it continues to deteriorate, will be a proxy battleground between what remains of the Alawite-controlled structure, where you will see a dissected Syria, where elements of the security forces that don't have a post-Assad future will rally, and you will see essentially the emergence of something like Somalia and the Levant, and that has all kinds of risks. Now, one of the reasons why actors like the United States have been reluctant to escalate this beyond a small fire under the Syrian pot is because of those risks. You have a very significant proliferation risk, whether it's in terms of shoulder-mounted anti-air missiles, anti-tank missiles, and, of course, chemical and biological systems. You have significant holdings across the country, and frankly, without boots on the ground, and boots on the ground that are reliable, it's very difficult to imagine how those systems will be secured. So it's a case of the international community weighing very carefully its international wants versus its international needs. It wants to see a change in Syria. It wants to see democracy and the Assads removed. But there is a need for some kind of modicum of predictability. And I know it's a lot to ask for given the high death toll, but the reality is that there are too many countries close by that are too critical to U.S. and international interests from the West, such as Jordan, such as Israel, Turkey, and of course countries like Iraq and Lebanon, to not factor them in effectively.
Well, I thank you very much for that rather sobering analysis and gives us quite a bit to think about. I thank you again, Aram Nagizian.
It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Aram Nagizian. He's a visiting fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's the author of a number of papers at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risks of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, the Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and his books include Israel and Syria, The Military Balance, and The Prospects of War. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a biographer of Vladimir Putin to get a sense of how his victory is going to be greeted in the West. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Treisman, a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia. He's a recipient of fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and is the author of two previous acclaimed books on Russia. His latest book just out is The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Treisman.
Thank you.
And the president and the State Department have, as far as I know, have yet to congratulate Vladimir Putin, who just won the Russian election amid charges of fraud and growing protests at home. Yet at the press conference yesterday, the president mentioned that he was looking forward to meeting with Putin at Camp David during the G8 summit. Can you explain that mixed message?
I think politicians in Washington understand that they're going to have to deal with Putin over the next 6 years, or at least as long as he remains in power, that Russia is an extremely important country in world affairs. We recognize that we have to work with the leaders of countries, even those whose political systems we don't entirely approve of. So I think there's an understandable realism in the response from Washington, at the same time as a recognition that the election was not as free and fair as one would have hoped it would be.
Well, it does seem that there's been quite a backlash to Putin, both starting with the enormous demonstrations that took place after the parliamentary elections, where the phrase for United Russia's the party of thieves and swindlers became a part of the national dialogue in Russia. And there have been subsequent demonstrations. And following the presidential election, there was a tremendous police presence. So clearly, Putin, who, you know, has moved very quickly when he took over to control the media, to control the judiciary, and to control the entire country, it doesn't seem to be too popular, at least at home in Moscow.
Well, that's right, but I think we need to distinguish. There are really two Russias, or at least two Russias at this point. But first of all, there's the Russia of the modern cities, the highly educated classes, who have more than one cell phone per person, who travel abroad, who spend a good part of their time on the internet. Now, that part of Russia, or we could call that the modern Russia, has in the last year completely turned off Putin. But there's also the traditional or dependent, or one could even say paternalist, Russia out in the provinces, where people really depend on the state for financial support. Enterprises that could not keep going without subsidies and bailouts, and the armies of public employees, teachers, doctors in the provinces, who really know that they don't have great alternative workplaces if they were to lose their jobs, and who depend on the central government continuing to redistribute money to them. And in that community, there's much more of a desire for stability, even if things are not perfect, and there's a certain level of dependence and not wanting to rock the boat. So on the one hand, Putin has really lost support in the cities, but he still remains quite popular, even if it's a sort of grudging approval in the provinces.
Well, it seems, though, that there's an element now developing of the emperor has no clothes. And to some extent, Putin, like Stalin and other Russian leaders, has tried to encourage a kind of cult of personality. And apparently, he even went to the point of having some plastic surgery or some Botox, which does appear to have backfired somewhat. There's something odd about his appearance. Do you think, though, that that's the beginning of the end? Because he has created, and it's remarkable in such a short period of time how he reversed the trajectory of Russian democracy, controlled the press, controlled the judiciary, and jailed oligarchs he didn't like and basically regulated the rest of them and has absolute power. And now he doesn't have the respect that I imagine he craves for.
That's right. We need to remember he had 8 years of really miraculous economic growth, extremely high economic growth, in large part associated with the rising oil price in the early 2000s. So 2000 to 2008, the economy was recovering very rapidly, modernizing very rapidly, and Putin was extremely popular. But now we've had 4 years of much more depressed economic conditions after the global financial crisis. And although Russia has managed to struggle through and is not doing as badly as it, perhaps it might have been doing, still, it's a big change from the years of boom recently. And so this has definitely pulled down Putin's approval. And there's been a real fascinating change in atmosphere during the last year or so among the elite. And it's exactly as you say, a sort of naked emperor phenomenon. I remember seeing in February of last year, so about exactly a year ago, there was a conference to recognize 80 years since former President Yeltsin's birth. And Putin came and addressed the conference and gave a short speech, which was actually extremely gracious and complimentary and well-written. Almost nobody clapped. And there was a moment, there was a sense in the hall that something fundamental had changed, that people were now not willing to give him the sort of perhaps grudging, but nevertheless respect that had been customary till then. And since then, it's just accelerated. He's widely criticized on the internet, widely criticized by Russians in the protests, but also this sense that, this, as you said, this slogan, this phrase, the party of thieves and swindlers, has really seeped into the common discourse, and I think about 50% of Russians in one poll said they recognize that phrase. So the notion that he could control the airwaves and control how people were talking, that's really gone by the board.
But when you say he doesn't have the respect that he used to have, if indeed he did, I'm astounded, though. It's taken so long, it seems to me, for people to recognize so much of what's happened in Russia that was so ugly and murderous and thug-like, how it wasn't somehow connected to Putin. He's gotten away with respect in the West. He's lost it at home, at least, brave journalists and everywhere in the blogosphere, people are recognizing what I think is pretty obvious, that Putin had a hand in blowing up the apartment buildings that was the pretext for the Second Chechen War that put him on the map. He was handled the theater takeover that ended up in a massive tragedy and unnecessary loss of ordinary Russians' lives. Many now beginning to see that as a staged KGB event, the poisoning with polonium of a Russian dissident, and so on and so on. I mean, the record is amazing, and nobody's wanted to really basically call it like it is. So, do you think we're going to reach a point now where the Western leaders recognize they're sitting down with a thug?
Well, I think some Western leaders have that view. And he's not the only thug they sit down with if he is a thug. But I wouldn't jump to conclusions, Ian. On a lot of those cases that you mentioned, there are suspicious circumstances. The truth may be more complicated than we imagine. And, we could talk about the individual issues that you raised, but I wouldn't say that it's an established fact that the KGB blew up, or the FSB, the former KGB, blew up the apartment buildings. Clearly, the preparation for the raid on the Moscow theater to free the hostages in 2002 was bungled in a really awful way, which cost many people their lives. There's a lot of things which look very ugly where people have asserted that Putin was himself personally involved. I think we need to be a little bit careful and look at the evidence and reserve judgment until there really is solid proof.
Sure, but this is a man who's absolutely in charge of a country where there's been no justice for Anna Politkovskaya and all of the events that we're talking about. In fact, we haven't even scratched the surface on a lot of them. So he can't surely get off scot-free.
No, I'm certainly not saying he should get off scot-free. I'm saying we should look at the individual cases.
Well, just in closing then, Daniel Treisman, do you think that just as Putin has lost respect to the extent in the way that there's this emperor's clothes phenomenon unleashed in Soviet, in Russia, and presumably you can't put that back in the bottle, do you think it's going to spread internationally? I mean, just in terms of international thuggery, if you will, it's pretty brazen what's happening in Syria, that Russia supports Syria, sells arms to Syria, doesn't care about the Syrian dictator murdering his own people. It's almost become a proxy war with echoes of the Cold War.
Well, you know, there too. We shouldn't forget that in the same week that the U.S. State Department was criticizing Putin for supporting Syria, they removed an embargo against Uzbekistan, where a very unattractive dictator had used his troops to butcher protesters a few years before. When it comes down to it, and we started with this, American foreign policy has this realistic element, and the Russians are perhaps beyond realistic. They're cynical, but all countries deal with leaders like Syria's Assad, who are guilty of serious crimes against their own people. I think the Russians have some concerns, which one may not share exactly, but which are legitimate, about what will happen in Syria after Assad falls. And I think most people believe that he will fall sometime fairly soon. But the country is ethnically divided, religiously divided, I should say, more than ethnically. Minority communities are very concerned that if the Sunnis dominate, there could be a very bloody civil war. So I think that the Russians are concerned about that and instability in the Middle East spreading, and Iran feeling even more under pressure if it loses its Syrian ally. And the Russians are alarmed seeing these repeated interventions by the U.S. or by NATO across the Middle East, in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya. They're cynical, but they don't see this as sort of a long string of humanitarian gestures. They see this as using the military force of the superpower to spread influence around the world.
Well, do you think, though, that just as Putin may feel the need to crack down at home, if he's losing his legitimacy, you don't think he's capable of any kind of foreign adventures?
He's capable. It's impossible to predict exactly what he'll do. Foreign adventures are certainly not going to help him at this point, and I think cracking down at home is going to be very difficult.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Daniel Treisman.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking to Daniel Treisman, a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia and a recipient of fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation and the German Marshall Fund of the United States. He's the author of two previous acclaimed books on Russia, and his latest is The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.